I'm Sarah Flounders, and I am the host of tonight's Workers' World webinar. I'm a contributing editor to Workers' World newspaper and part of the International Action Center and many anti-military efforts. We want to show concrete material to expose and combat U.S. war threats and escalating propaganda against the People's Republic of China. Every time the U.S. targets a country, it immediately whips up a racist campaign in the background to create a climate of fear, blanketing the news to silent opposition. Thousands of reports. It's relentless. Trump is doing this in the most vicious way, but Trump is not the first. In this country built on racism, slavery, genocide, it's a fabric of every political act and every war. Racism against Black people, all people of color, against migrants. We saw vicious anti-Muslim attacks used for the decades of U.S. wars in the Middle East and Central Asia, from Afghanistan to Iraq, Libya, Syria, Sudan, Somalia, and in U.S. support of Israel's war on the Palestinians. Muslims were labeled terrorists, rounded up, deported en masse, disappeared, jailed. We can't forget the tens of thousands of Japanese people were rounded into concentration camps in World War II, but not German or Italian people. That's racism in the U.S. And what about today and the COVID-19 pandemic that's hit harder in the United States due to a complete lack of preparation? We're in the midst of a total capitalist economic collapse, a real capitalist collapse. So there's a U.S. failure to protect the population here or to contain the COVID virus, and it's being all diverted into a blame China campaign rather than learn from China and what it has done so successfully. Now, from the earliest days of Workers' World Party, we've been discussing the impact of the Chinese Revolution on the global class struggle. We evaluated China as one of the most thoroughgoing revolutionary upheavals in history, and it impacted profoundly the class struggle in the U.S. and worldwide. And the whole U.S. ruling class was shocked in 1949 with the victory of the Red Army in China. It awakened a world movement across Asia and Africa against colonialism and Western domination, and it was a huge setback for imperialist plans. It was a major question of the Cold War and the 1950s witch hunt in the U.S. Who lost China? That's how they posed it. The Korean War, the Vietnam War, the efforts to turn back this revolutionary surge for self-determination and sovereignty. And then in 1979, the U.S. capitalist class had a new hope that they could gain a foothold in China through the expanding capitalist market and overturn the huge accomplishment of the Chinese Revolution. But starting with a pivot to Asia, a military realignment under the Obama administration, it reflected a realization that U.S. imperialism's hopes of an overturn were an illusion. China had a strong central government, central planning, and had rapidly developed into the world's second largest economy. It was a historic accomplishment, not only to feed the entire population, but to lift 800 million people out of dire poverty and illiteracy. Today, U.S. rulers, from liberals to conservatives, Democrats to Republicans, are united in attacking China and blaming each other for not being harsh or threatening enough. There was a unanimous vote in Congress for new sanctions against China. And we certainly face a dangerous situation today with two nuclear aircraft carrier battle groups, each with accompanying destroyers, frigates, nuclear subs, 70 aircraft, a B-1 supersonic bomber, enforcing freedom of navigation in the South China Sea. It's denounced by China as inciting a confrontation. The U.S. wants to return to the days when there were fleets of naval gunboats on the rivers of China, 100 miles inland. That was the U.S. Navy in China before the revolution. The U.S. Navy was there to protect free trade and opium. It's staggering hypocrisy for the U.S. government to claim support of Muslims in Xinjiang when they have spent decades on wars and bombings and invasions and occupations against Muslim people, where they built special jails to jail Muslims from Guantanamo to Bagram. So it's really an effort to rewrite history. And it's all made all more dangerous by the global capitalist economic crash. Now, like clockwork, capitalism crashes. There's a recession or a depression every 7 to 10 years for the last 300 years. But this capitalist crash comes with a global pandemic of a new virus, the COVID-19 virus, and that changes everything. While China is building an increasingly coordinated economy based on planning and human needs, in the U.S., the center of world capitalism, there's decades spent in building the most fabulously expensive military machine in history, and a huge repressive apparatus of police and prisons. It's an endless source of profit to the military industries. And yet, here, there's no infrastructure in public health. Doesn't exist. A child born in Beijing today has a much longer life expectancy than a child born in Chicago or Washington, D.C. China's COVID fatalities are under 5,000 people, and it's 140,000 fatalities in the U.S., 3 million testing positive. Why? China used a scientific approach, testing, tracking, huge supplies of essential materials, and a social mobilization of the entire population. In the U.S., no public action, no social mobilization, no necessary materials in place, just complete incompetence and disarray. So, resorting to blame China and raw anti-communism. And even worse, there's a use of the capitalist crash and the COVID global shutdown, not for cooperation, but to intensify sanctions, a weapon of shortages and economic crisis, and in a time when countries are the most vulnerable. But the more the U.S. imposes sanctions on countries, China has established trade and aid toward Venezuela, Iran, Syria, Cuba, throughout Africa. It's impacting the entire world order from the way that U.S. imperialism wants to run things. Here, everything, first, foremost, and always, is does it make a profit? So tonight, we say it's not democracy in Hong Kong to finance, train, and organize destruction, disruptions, and it's not human rights to vote sanctions on China or 39 other targeted countries globally, a third of the world population. And it's not freedom of navigation or freedom of trade to bring aircraft carriers and missile batteries to surround China. Just like it's not about police in the U.S. being for protection of our communities. We have to tear down these racist myths. We hope to do that in this program because we need to build unity among all the forces that are challenging U.S. corporate lies and threats. We may not agree on every point on the complex social development in China and even its class character, but I think we can all agree that U.S. imperialism is not ever a force for liberation or for human progress. So it's really an honor to introduce our next speaker, Monica Moorhead, who is the editor, managing editor of Workers' World newspaper. She's been the commentator on many past webinars here and really frames this in a way I think that would be very helpful. So, Monica.
Thank you, Sarah, and good evening, everyone. Tonight, we are discussing U.S. imperialism's growing threats against People's China, a revolution that has changed world history. Imperialism's strategy from the first day was how to overturn this revolution. China has grown in its ability to not only feed its entire people and provide housing and healthcare and stability. It has developed enormously. It is now a major world economic power. This accomplishment is a threat to the imperialist Western corporate rulers, especially here in the U.S. To understand the relationship between U.S. imperialism and China, one must understand imperialism as an economic system, not as a policy. One of the five basic features Vladimir Lenin laid out in his 1916 Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism book was completion of the territorial division of the whole world among the biggest capitalist powers. China was ruled with an iron fist as a colony by both Britain and Japan before its socialist revolution in 1949. Imperialism is capitalism at that stage of development at which the dominance of monopolies and finance capital is established. In the 1968 pamphlet, Expanding Empire, Workers' World Party founding member Vince Copeland states, and I quote, "The investment of capital in a foreign country should be regarded somewhat like sending a huge suction pump there, which pulls out the metals from the ground, the products from the soil, and the fruits from the trees, with the help, of course, of the labor of the quote-unquote native people or workers working on this suction pump. It is as if the pump were connected to pipes that run back to the home or the capitalist country via the banks and big corporations. All the rich products are showered from the pipes into the treasuries of these institutions in the form of profits. Whole nations are drained by these great suction pumps or investments. And the profits are so great that rival groups of big business, led by small cliques of big banks, go to war with each other over the exploitation of these nations," end quote. Both Lenin and Copeland, over a span of 50 years, were describing the same imperialism as rich capitalist countries getting richer off the systemic underdevelopment of the oppressed nations that get poor through the debt crisis, war, sanctions, and occupation. There are oppressed nations within the U.S. of Black, Brown, and Indigenous people who are disproportionately poor compared to the whites. Therefore, imperialism has created a war at home and abroad. This super exploitation is the economic basis for countries in Africa, Latin America, the Caribbean, Asia, the Middle East, and oppressed nations at home having the right to sovereignty or self-determination, that is, to determine on how best to develop their economies, societies, and communities to meet the basic and cultural needs of their population without the bullying interference of the corporate bosses and militarism. This is the basis upon which China must be defended against imperialism. The COVID-19 pandemic ripped off the Band-Aid of this cancerous, monstrous system, which has left billions more workers and oppressed people on a global scale so vulnerable to suffering and deaths due to a lack of health care, food, shelter, clean water, the right to a job or income, and more, including right here in the belly of the beast. And hunger is predicted to take more lives during the pandemic on a global scale. And we must really be vigilant when it comes to the mass evictions that are to come in the millions by the end of next month. Now the whole world can see that the U.S. is incapable of protecting its own population. There is no public health system compared to China's huge public health system for more than a billion people. U.S. infrastructure is crumbling while corporate profits are soaring. Meanwhile, the U.S. has nothing to offer the people of the world except for terrorist threats and more suffering. These weaknesses make the U.S. more dangerous than at any time in its history, because it is a desperate, dying system in permanent crisis, whose profits are based on militarism and war. We are in the midst of a global capitalist economic crisis and a global health pandemic. Millions of angry youth of all nationalities are on the move, challenging this white supremacist system, especially police brutality, in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. It is a perfect storm. U.S. rulers are united in wanting to turn this anger, this economic pain, and this fear of virus into a blame China campaign, and we say no. Intensifying the class struggle inside the United States is the most effective method for socialists and revolutionaries here to show political solidarity for oppressed peoples and workers inside and outside these artificial borders, whose only so-called crimes have been to fight for economic independence and political equality by any means necessary. And China is an example of fighting for its right to sovereignty and self-determination. With no other options, countries have and more will turn towards socialist reconstruction and equitable trade as the only answer to imperialist underdevelopment. Our solidarity and our determined opposition to U.S. sanctions and war threats, starting with China, can have a huge, tremendous impact. Build a workers' world. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Monica. And we'd next like to invite Soo-Hin Lee, who is with the China-U.S. Solidarity Network and the National Immigrant Solidarity Network. I traveled with Soo-Hin Lee to China for the 70th anniversary of the Chinese Revolution, an incredible celebration, an incredible experience. For many years, Soo-Hin Lee has been an activist with migrant and undocumented workers, along with doing China solidarity work, originally from Hong Kong.
Hi, everyone. My name is Soo-Hin. Dara had talked a lot about what is this situation. I want to be a little more in-depth to talk about the whole pictures. Right now, what happened is not just a COVID. It's also need to see the broader picture, what happened between China and the U.S. and the global situations. Sarah said we organized a delegation last October to go to China to witness the 70th anniversary of founding Foundation of People's Republic of China. But also we organized another delegation on December to January to went to Silk Road, to went to Xinjiang and meet with many activists. We know something is going to happen. We know that's going to have a heightened tensions between China and the U.S. That time still don't have COVID, but that has a several major escalation, include the so-called trade war, the U.S. involvement, COVID action, the so-called revolution in Hong Kong, my hometown. Also, the U.S. military naval ship has been sailing and close to the South China Sea and near the Chinese coast, as well as Huawei and all these so-called bogus China spy allegation in the U.S. So December last year was a very tense moment that all these things piling up against China. But China successfully fought most of them. That was the end of the December when we were in Xinjiang, meet with many people and talk about, because we worry about that maybe U.S. is going to launch something in China, from maybe a protest to all these kind of political things, because U.S. has been pushing for several resolutions, such as Uyghur human rights, so-called Uyghur Human Rights Act, pushing the Hong Kong legislation, etc. At the end of the delegation, I would say around January 2nd or 3rd this year, we start hearing the story about there's some kind of virus broke out in Wuhan. Then people start worrying about, and the government start warning everyone to be start preparing and to be careful about health and safety. And I was staying in China until January 20th, when the situation getting worse and worse and worse. But I also have the opportunity to witness what China has done to fight against the pandemic and mobilize the national population, not everyone, to be involved in the so-called the people's war against the virus. So this is not a simply speaking that China can win the beat back the COVID within 2 months. It's a luck. It's a really talking about a socialism under China's characteristics that able to mobilize national capacity to fight against the virus that no one heard about. That's also the reason why U.S. failed, because U.S. has been obsessed against China, the China bashing, and then also the Cold War against China. That's the reason why that's all this Trump is so furious, because he definitely lost. That's the one of the reasons why he had been so furious against the World Health Organization, accusing them there's a proxy of China, which is completely bogus, not true. But on the same time, that also been spreading all these unfounded hoax about so-called the Wuhan military lab virus. Because what is it, you got to understand, this is not just talking about blaming China, the virus, but also this is a whole thing, is one to contain and against China, the hopefully that this can be become a so at the beginning, if you remember, people had the right-wing Republicans, or even some media have been calling this a China's Chernobyl. Hopefully that will become a disaster, and that will be a national disaster that will be China cannot handle, and then at the end people are angry, uprising, overthrowing the government, then the U.S. can be victorious, just like the mentality what that time from Trump to right-wing Republican, it's just like a losing gambler desperately looking for some way to turn the table back against China, then can be victorious. That is a pawn talk. That is a Cold War mentality. That is a racism. That's with any cost they want against China, the success. Right now, U.S., the COVID has been completely dysfunctional, the response dysfunctional, and also has been failed. The next fight will be the vaccine, the so-called vaccine. China under socialism, able to mobilize national effort to not just combat virus, but also to organize to develop vaccines. Just to make it simple, they're saying right now, there's total 17 vaccines on the clinical trial. China already has total 9. Compared with U.S., is 4. So China is right now have several are very promising compared with U.S., but could be ready by next year. That's what exactly U.S. don't want to be seeing. Why? That's very simple. Imperialism and capitalism. Imperialism, what that means. If China can develop a vaccine, can be safely used, can be ready available, China already promised that the intellectual property will be free to every country. That means that China will be leading the way on fighting the virus, not the U.S. That's exactly what U.S. doesn't want to see. Besides the money the U.S. can make, and then they thought that this is the money supposed to be U.S. make, not other country. So I appeal to everyone. This is not a just like talking about it's only a virus fight, but also it's a struggle. International solidarity. Also, international solidarity against U.S. imperialism from China to Africa to Middle East to Latin Americas, everywhere that has been devastated, tens, hundreds of millions, billions of people. If we can unite, we can win the struggle, not only COVID fight, but justice, social justice, and economic justice. What we saw on the Black Lives Matter movement, we have been, if we can unify, we can work together, we can succeed, we can accomplish something. Right now, we are working with Sarah and developing a book. We just thought about it 2 months ago. We should write a book about why China successfully fight the COVID and why U.S. fail. We can talk about that a little later, but I hope that book and then our discussions can enlighten people, learn something new, that why we can learn from China, and then why is international solidarity is so important. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Suhin. And yes, we look forward. We're going to hear more about this book, so stay tuned. I think it will be a real contribution to the discussion and very informative. People all over the country, it has a wide range of writers. So next, we would like to call on Calvin Dushbien, who is an activist with International Action Center, and he has prepared a very effective fact sheet. So, Calvin?
Hello, and thank you. My name is Calvin Deutschbein with the International Action Center, and I prefer they or any pronouns. I've been having conversations about COVID-19 and the U.S. and China responses with members of my family and my union, so I created a series of 8 facts to talk through what I believe an effective response should be. Fact number 1. The United States has more cases than anywhere in the world. On July 4th, 2020, there were 2.8 million confirmed U.S. cases, over 25% of the world's total of 11.1 million. Brazil, which has the next most confirmed cases, has only about half as many as the U.S. at 1.5 million. China has only 84,000, Iran 240,000, and the entire European Union, including Britain, has about 1.5 million per the European Union Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Fact number 2, the U.S. outbreak is growing faster than anywhere in the world. The U.S. has had the most daily cases anywhere in the world since early March, other than a brief period from when Brazil matched the U.S., and the growth rate continues to increase. As of July 4th, the U.S. had 132,000 deaths, 661 in the past 24 hours. China has only had 4,634 deaths total, with the most recent on May 16th. Fact number 3, the U.S. for-profit healthcare system makes treatment inaccessible. The United States spends 17% of its GDP, or gross domestic product, on healthcare, over half again over the next highest nation, 11% in Switzerland. Yet only 84% of adults see a doctor in a given year, and drugs cost more than anywhere else in the world. The U.S. has fewer hospital beds per person than 80% of other nations and closes hospitals faster than 80% of other nations, even while experiencing major population growth. Fact number 4, the United States has refused international aid. Within 12 days of the discovery of the virus in Wuhan, Chinese researchers isolated its genetic material and shared it with the World Health Organization, or WHO, to develop diagnostic tests that were available weeks before the first U.S. deaths. The U.S. did not collaborate with the Chinese or WHO researchers, leading to its own outbreak when U.S. developed tests failed. Fact number five. The United States failed to deploy disease control measures. The U.S. response never slowed the viral spread to half of its highest rate. And the U.S. reopened while having the most cases in the world and a faster viral spread than anywhere else in the world. In contrast, the Chinese response, especially in the city of Wuhan, sustained a lockdown of 57 million people until there were no new daily cases. Fact number six. In the U.S., responses focused on economic profits rather than human lives. The U.S. has spent trillions of dollars on Wall Street and the Pentagon instead of providing healthcare, housing, or food, and has only offered a single one-time cash payment to the people. The United States has no universal healthcare, no guaranteed housing, no guaranteed food security, and no guaranteed higher education programs, despite having arguably the highest wealth of any nation in the world in history. Fact number seven, effective responses center human needs. In contrast to the United States, China, which is still in many important ways a developing nation, has safely implemented ambitious containment programs based on collective and communal programs in healthcare, food stability, and education that were won by the Chinese people in their 1949 communist revolution. Fact number eight, the U.S. has turned to militarism over health. Since the outbreak, especially in the U.S., the United States has stoked xenophobic attacks against Chinese people, has falsely blamed China for spreading the virus, even when many U.S. cases were introduced by way of Europe, and many of the first U.S. cases were introduced by U.S. citizens being pulled out of Chinese mandated quarantine by their own federal government. The U.S. has aggressively placed two nuclear aircraft carrier battle groups in the South China Sea, disputed area on the southern part of China, leaked false intelligence reports from its national intelligence services claiming the virus was developed as a biological weapon, and generally adopted a posture of war with China especially, rather than one of peace, international collaboration, and the interests of the health of its own people. Here at the International Action Center, we have a lot of resources to talk through this, to learn more about this. The talk that I just given is available as both a slide deck and a fact sheet on iacenter.org, and we have some other resources that might be interesting and valuable to you. Most recently, we had a fact sheet also about the U.S. interactions with Hong Kong during the Hong Kong protests. And that's all available again at iacenter.org, so please come check us out. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Calvin. It does show it's so important to just provide the concrete facts and a context. So thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Sharat Lin. Dr. Sharat Lin is with the San Jose Peace and Justice Center. As a researcher, he writes and lectures on global political economy, labor, migration, Middle East, South Asia, and public health. He's been studying firsthand the historic transformation of China from the Cultural Revolution to the present. So, Dr. Lin, please join us.
Well, thank you to the Workers' World Party and International Action Center for inviting me to this webinar. I want to, first of all, frame why the United States is taking this very increasingly aggressive approach towards China. And I think that some of the other speakers have already touched on this. And U.S. capital is facing a challenge from the Chinese economy and the fact that China has seen an amazing growth rate, an amazing development of its own internal infrastructure, and has become, you know, by far the leading exporter of industrial goods to the rest of the world, sometimes called the factory of the China is the factory of the world. And that in the long run, of course, you know, threatens U.S. supremacy. And the United States is a leader only in the military, in the sense that the United States still spends nearly 50% of all dollars in the world on the military. Meanwhile, the Chinese economy, right now it stands at about $15 trillion in GDP versus the U.S. at about 22. And if you look at it in actual purchasing power parity terms, the Chinese economy is actually the world's largest economy. So that has long-term implications in terms of the ability of China to weather conflict between China and the U.S. in terms of being able to provide an alternative center of power in the world. On top of that, this conflict between U.S. capital and the rising China is the fact that we have a president right now who is reversing the globalization. Whatever you think of globalization, the point is that Mr. Trump is exercising a lot of ultra-nationalist rhetoric and actions in terms of pulling out of treaties, imposing sanctions, and doing all of these kinds of aggressive moves that are extra economic in the sense that they are not market-driven measures. And he's doing that because of the failure of the United States to combat the COVID-19, failure to, you know, maintain its industrial base, the failure of the U.S. to have a national healthcare system, housing for everyone, and so on. And so the way is to scapegoat another country, and certainly that included in that would be the world's rising power. And if you look at China, I have a more nuanced picture of China because it is, while it does have a socialist-oriented government, it is also, you know, 60% of the economy is essentially capitalist, and that sector continues to grow. But China, for example, does still have, for example, right now it has made a national commitment to reduce poverty to zero. I mean, of course, they have a certain definition, and many people would dispute that definition. But the point is, there is a national program which is targeted to finish by the end of this year, and according to their definition, to reduce poverty in the country to zero by the end of this year. The U.S. uses all kinds of means to demonize other countries, and one of them is human rights. So every year the State Department produces a report to the president on human rights, and the White House basically uses that selectively to target countries. I mean, there's a section there on Saudi Arabia, but the administration never raises the points about human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia, but they do in China. I was just in Xinjiang, and I had a firsthand chance to see what is really going on there. And I see that, you know, it's not a question of repression. Yes, there's a heavy police presence. The actual number of new imprisonments, which is in response to a very, very tangible terrorist threat that, you know, a lot of the Uyghur fighters have been found in Syria fighting with the jihadis. And the actual number, according to China's own official incarceration figures, they have risen over the past 5 to 7 years by a factor of about 200,000 in Xinjiang. It's an extraordinary number, but it's not the 1 million or 2 million that is sometimes cited by U.S. government figures or by the media without any documentation of how they get those kind of figures. So the human rights issue is used very selectively when the U.S. wants to to target another country or attack another country. The Huawei case, Huawei is China's leading telecom and mobile phone manufacturer. And it's been targeted because of its being a Chinese company, that it will compromise security of telecoms in, you know, wherever Huawei equipment is used. And no one's ever proven that, but, you know, one has to be reminded that every U.S. manufacturer is required, and there is resistance, but they're required to build a backdoor for the FBI to spy through U.S. equipment. So it's not really any different with the U.S., and I don't think that Huawei is any different. Because Huawei is not a state-owned company. It's actually owned by the employees, at least officially. A lot of this bashing is artificial. China is not perfect. It's not an ideal socialist country, but a lot of this bashing is because of imperialism's own failure and its desperate attempts to remain the sole superpower in the world, a position from which it can dominate and impose its will on the rest of the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sharat Lin. We next want to move to Dave Welsh, who is a delegate to the San Francisco Labor Council. Dave is a retired postal worker. He has decades as a labor activist. And just this week, he was able to introduce a very important labor resolution to the council. And Dave, if you would tell us about that, that would be great. So, Dave Welsh.
Yes, thank you, Sarah. We have a meeting once a month of the Labor Council, and the delegates from the different unions represented by the Labor Council come together, 75 participants from the different unions. And I was there representing the letter carriers, the people who deliver your mail. And we discussed the issue of the attacks on China being launched by the President of the United States, Mr. Trump, and supported to some degree, to quite a degree, by the Democrats. I mean, the Congress, the Democrats, as well as the Republicans, voted to heighten sanctions against China. This is crazy. I mean, this is an interdependent world where how another economy develops affects our country and affects our workers and affects our consumers. Let me talk a little bit about the resolution. The resolution says that the so-called Pivot to Asia Act of 2011 was in fact a pivot toward war and confrontation that identified China as a competitor and an adversary, carrying with it the threat, the U.S. threat of nuclear war against China. And then the resolution goes on to say this dangerous policy has created palpable feelings of fear, animosity, and even hatred, not only towards the People's Republic of China, but towards Chinese people in general, and Chinese American citizens, and other Asian peoples in the United States. And, you know, that means we have to go back to the Second World War, when the United States and Japan were at war in the Pacific theater. And the United States rounded up Japanese Americans in the continental United States and put them in concentration camps for the duration of the war. I mean, this was outrageous. Basically, the Japanese American citizens had their land stolen, and they were deprived of livelihood, and they were cooped up with their families in these barbed wire camps. Well, right now, you see a resurgence of this kind of thing against Chinese Americans as people try to scapegoat China for the COVID outbreak. Now, China has had something like 4,500. The United States has had hundreds of thousands of deaths from COVID. So China moved rapidly to limit the damage and to stop the spread of the virus. The United States has not done so. Now, one of the reasons for that could be that China has a socialist system and they can mobilize to protect the people from a real danger to their health and livelihoods. And they did it. They used the power of the government of China to isolate the virus and to protect people so it would stop spreading. That's what we need to do. Now, the resolution goes on to say that the dangerous policy started with the pivot to Asia of 2011 has created palpable feelings of fear, animosity, and even hatred toward the People's Republic of China and towards Chinese people in general and others of Asian descent in the United States. And the resolution goes on to say that humanity now faces multiple crises that threaten the well-being and very survival of our species, crises which demand the cooperation of the two largest and most powerful countries, China and the United States. Now, why is it that when the United States starts to have a serious economic crisis, first reaction of the political leadership of the two major parties seems to be to prepare for war? Now, this is not a rational way of dealing with things. We need cooperation. We need peace to deal with this issue like the COVID epidemic. Anyway, the Labor Council, you know, I say San Francisco Labor Council, everybody may not know exactly what a Labor Council is. Maybe four or five delegates from my branch that represents the letter carriers that deliver the mail. And we go there and we meet once a month in the Plumbers Hall in San Francisco and discuss these issues that affect organized labor in the United States. And the San Francisco Labor Council has taken the lead on many issues, like arguing against the Iraq war, the war against Iraq, arguing against the preparations for war against Iran. And the Labor Council has taken positions counter to that. I said, wait a minute now, who's going to be fighting those wars? The workers of the United States, our members and their children are going to be the ones fighting this war. And so therefore we have to oppose it. This is a labor issue. If you're going to be sending my son and my daughter off to someplace thousands of miles from where we live to fight a war with some other country, this is not rational. This does not make any sense. And I think eventually we can prevail. So the resolution concluded that urging the government of the United States to reject escalation towards global conflict and instead pursue peace, non-intervention, and cooperation with China and the rest of the world. You know that the working class that I'm part of, we don't want to go to war. We don't want to go and subject our bodies, the bodies of our children, our neighbors, to these terrible, a lot of veterans are in our labor council, people who survived these vicious wars and came back, maybe not all in one piece, but with most of their pieces still intact. So I think the labor council, speaking for organized labor, but also for the unorganized part of the working class, which is the larger part, say, look, we don't need this war. We don't need to be sending two different battle groups of aircraft carriers and offensive weapons, including nuclear-armed weapons, into the South China Sea. How would we feel if China or some other country came and up and down the coast of California, up and down the coast of the East Coast, the Carolinas or New York, brought in weapons of war, weapons of mass destruction? This is not something that we need. We need peace in order to develop in a way that's going to benefit our children, our neighbors, our friends and loved ones. And I think this is totally unnecessary, but you know, it flows from the way the capitalist system is organized, and especially the United States, which is doing not so well economically. They're not doing so well. This COVID-19 epidemic has greatly hurt the ability of the United States economy to produce what it needs and to employ people. You know the millions of people who've been thrown onto the rolls of unemployed and who have been laid off from their jobs, and it hasn't even begun yet. This is something very serious, and we need the cooperation of the government of China and many other countries around the world. We don't need to be hostile. We should be friendly with the world. That's what people want. People want to be able to bring their families up and develop themselves and develop cultural life of the country in peace. Is that so hard? I mean, that's what we need. We need peace so we can all get along. That's what we need. That's why we need to have some socialism. Because this system we've got now is such a warlike system, and when it gets in trouble, it starts building the bombs. That's what's happening. And the San Francisco Labor Council is, I believe, to my best of my knowledge, is the first labor organization to come out against the building war against China and other countries. And the resolution says it all when it says we need a pivot to peace with China and the world. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dave. And I think that's a great example. We're going to take questions to the panel. So I want to encourage everyone to, if you have a question, there's no way we can answer all the questions that have come in, but we'll try to choose a few things to focus on and really kind of deal with them in this discussion. We want to also go through upcoming webinars that are happening and kind of focus on that too. So let me just say before that, I guess we'll take this as a station break because having resources is extremely important. People want to know where they can go to find facts and information, and along with encouraging you to really look at workers.org, I want to first mention the Chow Collective. That's chowcollective.com. They also have a Facebook site, and it is a collective of diaspora Chinese challenging U.S. aggression on China. And they say that their aim is to challenge U.S. rising aggression toward People's Republic of China and to be a bridge between the U.S. left, particularly the Chinese diaspora left, and China's rich Marxist, anti-imperialist, historical, and contemporary political work and thought, and to build a movement of leftists determined to push back against the U.S. increasing aggression against China, to critically consider the current role of China and socialism with Chinese characteristics in contemporary geopolitics, and to disrupt Western misinformation and propaganda. So that's a good site to look to also, and I would recommend it. I want to say that there is another webinar coming up. It's an international webinar, and so you can be on it almost, it's depending on what hour, round the clock, called NoColdWar.org. It's an international China webinar with a number of speakers, and there will be other ones held in the future also. So this is the first one on this focus. And again, seeking to answer and provide resources and information on China and this growing U.S. instigated conflict. We want to support the efforts of the Pivot to Peace. There's a video called Hong Kong Follow the Money, and we want to thank the Peace Report on that. It's had more than 150,000 views on YouTube, and it goes through some of the history of China and the U.S. funding through the National Endowment for Democracy. So that video and many other videos, which we list on, you know, workers.org, you can check. I want to also announce just before we go to that, that on August 6th, Veterans for Peace is having an online convention, and part of it is a China webinar on the Pivot to Peace. So you might want to tune in to veteransforpeace.org to check out that webinar. And all of this is to say that there is just a wealth of information out there. I want to next encourage you to really check out Join Workers World. if you want to be in the struggle and fill out a form online, we'll get back to you, because it is a political struggle. It's a struggle in the streets here. As we know, the last 2 months have been intense against the police. The demands to abolish the police, abolish the Pentagon. It goes hand in hand, and it takes a people's movement. So fill out that form, at least if you want to hear from us. If you want to get daily news updates, then fill out another form, and that is to get articles from Workers World on a daily basis by email. You can subscribe and you can unsubscribe at any time, but it's a good source of information. And we link to other groups all the time whose work is, we think, important and in line with what we're doing. And there's one final thing, because we do live in a capitalist society and everything costs money, even though we're an all-volunteer organization. But donating just these webinars, the online work, everything in print costs a great deal of money. So if you can donate, you can do so at Venmo at Workers World, or on the website workers.org, donate, or on the patreon.com/WWP. Donations to the Patreon go to help our subscriptions to prisoners. A third of our subscription list was for those incarcerated. This is really part of the working class, our class here, and we want to show specially support. So at any rate, those are some things that you can do, and we're going to move to a few of the questions. We did promise also Soo-Hin Lee there would be time to describe this book. So why don't we go to that while we look at the questions that have come up, and ask you, Soo-Hin, to describe this book project, because that, I think, is another thing that will be an important resource. That's what we're really seeking to do. How do we defeat this propaganda? And we got to do so with facts and counter it. Okay, Soo-Hin.
Thank you, Sala. We are almost finished the book, and its title is called Capitalism on a Ventilator: Impact of COVID-19 in China versus U.S. It's a joint project with our organization, China-U.S. Solidarity Network, with International Action Center. We are still finalizing the book with a collection of different writers, including me and Sarah and other people. Going to have close to 60 articles from different organizations and media outlets that will focus on several issues. Number one, Section 1, a warning from China, why U.S. missed the sign. Then Section 2 will be called Blaming China, why U.S. fell on fighting the COVID-19, not instead they just blaming China, Chinophobia. And Section 3, the spiraling disaster in the U.S., why the U.S. COVID fight has been so dysfunctional, so disastrous, a systematic analysis. And then the Section 4, systematic U.S. racism and COVID-19. It affects every sector of the society, but people of color, African-American, Latinos, and many low-income families affect the most. And then Section 5, Global Aid from China. That chapter is very interesting because most people did not know that China aid COVID fight around the world since Wuhan have able to beat the virus and turn to zero in China on early March, they've been start sending aids and medics around the world, over 100 countries and international organizations. And last but not least, the Section 6, race for the vaccine, cooperation versus competition. why China and the World Health Organizations want this to be a public domain and can be benefit around everyone around the world when U.S. and Trump regime is against the idea and want the U.S. to be a sole developer and a manufacturer on the vaccine development. So this is a very interesting book. We are aiming to going to publish this book maybe sometime August. I think this is the only COVID-19 books in justice category. And also in comprehensive view, talking about why China succeeds, why U.S. fell, why international solidarity is so important versus imperialism is disastrous. So I hope this is a good book. And if anyone interested, and then me and Sarah was talking about maybe we can do a pre-order and so we can have see how many people interested. And then when the book published, and then those people can get it first. So if anyone are interested, I don't know, how we're going to do it. Or either we're just going to people send us some email or pay online and then pre-order the books. And then we can have some initial order first. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Suhin. And yes, we will. I will say that everyone who has registered for these webinars, who signed up on our mailing list, will get a notice and a special reduced rate for this book because we want it as available as possible. And it also will have free downloads on our sites where you can download it in Kindle and as an EPUB if you want to actually get the printed book. And we'll have events for that also. Then we'll tell you how to order it and how to get a reduced rate. So look forward to it within the coming month. But if you're on our mailing list, you will hear from us about the book. So now I will say that there have been questions, and I want to ask if any of the panelists want to particularly address one of these questions. You can do so by volunteering and just jumping into the discussion for a minute. We want to have time for each person to, and I also would like to answer some of these questions, but of course we're not going to be able to deal with them all, but they're worth dealing with. And I think that we also, as we said in the fact sheets and articles, have provided the background for almost all of these questions. But let me first ask the panel before I continue if they have points that they want to address in the questions that have come in. Monica?
Yeah, I just wanted to, there's been a couple of questions about the relationship between China and Africa. I mean, you could almost do a whole webinar just on that. So this is not at all trying to fully answer that question. We have written about it in Workers' World newspaper, but I will say that the main thing is that China has taken more of a, in terms of providing skills and so forth with African countries, and not an exploitative relationship with Africa. It's been more of a pragmatic, I would say, relationship. China has been very supportive, for instance, in Zimbabwe, where they have provided aid for the projects that the people of Zimbabwe, which very similar to China from the point of view of, you know, you have a large peasantry, a lot of farmers. The economy in Zimbabwe is based, I think 80% of it is based on farming. And in the peasantry in Zimbabwe, a smaller working class. And so there is a special relationship between China and Zimbabwe. China has provided, you know, skilled labor and also material aid in terms of projects like building dams and so forth with the people of Zimbabwe. So you don't have the same super exploitative relationship between China and the people of Africa who have suffered from so much super exploitation, colonialization, neo-colonialism from Europe, and of course with the U.S., with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, the debt crisis, which Africa is suffering billions of dollars in terms of paying back these loans that have really set back development in Africa. So I would say that there is a more pragmatic relationship between China and Africa. And, you know, this needs to be studied more. And I do want to just say something. It's not a question I don't see, but I think it's important to reiterate that every struggle impacts another struggle, that no struggle is in isolation, no matter what the form may be. And I just want to raise this very interesting situation that happened in the area of mass culture when it comes to the Black Lives Matter movement in China, and that's around the issue of sports. There was an incident that happened a few days ago where this very, very ultra-right-wing racist senator from Missouri, Josh Hawley, he actually came out and criticized the National Basketball Association for not coming out, and, you know, the players are, you know, they're going to be trying to finish out the season, and the NBA is 80% African-American. So the players have a right to wear on their jerseys anything associated with Black Lives Matter if they want. And so this senator came out and said, well, he's very, very anti Black Lives Matter. And he said, well, why aren't the players coming out in with shirts that say Free Hong Kong? Or, you know, why is the NBA kowtowing to China, quote unquote? And one of the senior writers for the ESPN, Adrian Wojnarowski, answered the senator by saying "F you," and this became public, and so he was put on suspension by ESPN because this was a senator and so forth. You're not supposed to be political when it comes to ESPN, the largest sports network in the world. And what happened was very interesting, is that the players came to the defense of Adrian Wojnarowski. And it's really because, to make a long story short, it's because they felt that Wojnarowski was defending Black Lives Matter in his own way against this reactionary senator who has been very public against Black Lives Matter. So, and a lot of these players, they have a relationship with China because the NBA is so huge in China. And they have taken the stance of not interfering in the internal affairs of China, especially when it comes to Hong Kong. So I just wanted to raise that nowhere in the world can you, you know, the impact of what's going on inside the United States with Black Lives Matter is definitely having an impact on international affairs, like with China. And so it's something that it just shows growing mass class consciousness around this issue of white supremacy and not being diverted away from that.
Thank you. Thank you, Monica. We also, just to announce, it was a comment in the questions, were asked to support peace activists in Hawaii who are campaigning to cancel the RIMPAC. Those are U.S. military exercises that are scheduled for August 17th to the 31st. And we do urge people to support that. And we ask the activists who are raising it to please send us information. We'll make a point of covering it and publicizing it on the Workers' World News sites. This is important to do because this is a real people's effort against this huge military exercise, very much like what's going on right now in the South China Sea.
I wanted to respond to one of the questioners who was pointing out that Cuba has offered help, concrete help, in combating the COVID-19 virus. Just as when Katrina hit New Orleans, the hurricane and floods of Katrina hit New Orleans, Cuba offered help, concrete help, as they have helped with many natural disasters around the world, and sending their doctors all over the world to help cure diseases. And the United States rejected the aid of the Cubans. I mean, this is not, does not make any sense. I mean, right now, there's a number of people have offered their help, China included, help to the United States to help deal with the exploding pandemic here. And the United States has not taken them up on it. So this doesn't make sense. I mean, here you have some countries. These happen to be countries that are attempting to build socialism. And they're offering, in a generous effort to help some of the harder hit countries who are affected by the COVID-19 virus. And the United States is refusing it. This does not make any sense, brothers and sisters.
Thank you, Dave. No, it makes no sense. I think, Suhin, you're next, right?
Yes. Someone was asking about should U.S. activists support the Hong Kong Independent Union. I'm from Hong Kong. I am born in Hong Kong. I was in the labor movement in Hong Kong for close to 40 years. So I know most of the labor organizers in Hong Kong. So I can say something very specific. There's a big union in Hong Kong that represent majority of the workers. Is called the Hong Kong Federation of Trade Unions. That is a left-wing, progressive, pro-China labor union, just like AFL-CIO is umbrella of many unions in China, in Hong Kong, from at different sectors. However, that is the one, that's the one U.S. does not support. U.S. does not, U.S. is putting all the resources against. Just, and during the Hong Kong was still the British colony between, before 1997, the British Hong Kong colonial government has been against the Hong Kong Federation of Trade Unions. That's the reason. The colonists, the right wing, right wingers, the anti-communists in Hong Kong, they created the, another union. It's specifically to against the Hong Kong Federation of Trade Unions. Another one is called Hong Kong Confederation of Trade Unions. Because the name is so close, people sometimes could be really confused. They both have unions and federation, all these things, but Hong Kong Confederation of Trade Unions are not the Hong Kong Federation of Trade Unions. Hong Kong Confederation of Trade Unions are the right-wing, anti-communist, anti-China, and supported by the U.S., and they are the one who call, U.S. is called it an independent union, because under the umbrella, they create many proxy unions, branch unions, and to directly to in against the Hong Kong Federation of Trade Unions. So that, just to make it simple speaking, is a left-wing unions and right-wing unions, and right-wing unions are the ones who support by the U.S. and then endorsed and blessed by the AFL-CIO, specifically the Solidarity Center, who has been funded by the National Endowment for Democracy. That is also the Cold War arm, and then also the one who have been involved in the color revolution, exactly what have been happened in the Venezuela, the fake so-called trade unions against the Maduro's governments. That is the same thing, if you want to make it simple to understand. So if I'm specific, more specific upfront to say, there's no such thing as an independent union. Independent union in many countries, because they already has a union, and then they said that independent union usually is the one who backed by a Western country, funded by CIA, or funded by the National Endowment for Democracy to against the already hacked union, which had the more progressive, more revolutionary, more grassroots. One more thing I need to say, the Hong Kong Confederation of Trade Unions, the right wing, has been the main source behind the Hong Kong anti-government riots last year. They're the one who had been the one who behind the mobilize and then all this kind of logistics support and then funneling money from U.S. to Hong Kong to against the Hong Kong provisional government and also against the left-wing Hong Kong Federation of Trade Unions. So that kind of things we got to understand. And then I encourage anyone, if they say some things that independent union, you got to be very careful. There's no such thing as called as independent unions in many countries. And then if specific what U.S. said, what New York Times said, you got to be cautious. What Solidarity Center said, you got to be careful about that.
Thank you, Suhin. I think we're gonna wrap up with this just because it's that hour, it is that time. I want to describe upcoming webinars, but to close on saying this is where U.S. propaganda through unions, the Federation in Hong Kong and the Confederation, which was set up really to counter and is tied to U.S. money, the National Endowment for Democracy, which has nothing to do with democracy. And it's the same thing in Xinjiang. I think very important to look at. The U.S. spent four decades, that's not a short period of time, two generations, recruiting mercenaries in the most isolated and least developed part of China, in Xinjiang, which is now a crucial part in the Belt and Road program. But recruiting Uyghur mercenaries at very high pay into the war right next door in Afghanistan. And this was a U.S.-Saudi Arabia project and the idea of using it back against China. But the Uyghurs were actively recruited. There were 100,000 Uyghur mercenaries in Syria who fought with ISIS. That's not a small number. So this is a long-term project that went on to try to build a separatist movement to pay for it. And the support for this movement is really based in Washington, D.C. And there's a lot of information I could point to on workers.org, but I'd also suggest you check out Gray Zone that has covered this extensively. By the way, earlier when I mentioned the Chow Collective, I really should have spelled it for those of you who are listening audibly, and that is QIAO Collective. Now, as we close, I want to say these webinars are such an important way for us to connect that our webinar next Thursday, that's July 23rd, is going to be a book launch for our new book that's just out. The China book is coming soon, but the book that is just out is called What Road to Socialism? And it's a Workers' World anthology with a number of the leading Workers' World, thinkers and writers and journalists. All of the articles are from Workers' World, and it is really talking about workers' struggle, revolutionary struggles versus reformism, and looking at social democracy and revolutionary politics. So I encourage you to tune in to some of the authors who will be describing what they were thinking of, working on, focusing when they were writing this. It came out just before the lynching, that brutal murder of George Floyd, and the uprising that, and yet everything in this book talks about the coming uprising. So come join us next week for that. To say that the week after, let me just look at the notes on this, which is the 30th, we have the Workers' World Party's Disability Rights Caucus. We'll be hosting at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time, a webinar titled Smash Ableism, Racism, and All Bigotry and Oppression, and Build a World that Provides to Each According to Our Needs and Receives from Each According to Our Abilities. That is a tremendous slogan from Marxism that is so well put and important to remember in the struggle for people with disabilities. So that's the 30th. Just to say also on Thursday, August 13th, we will have a salute to Black August. So tune in, very much important focus, the salute to Black August. I hope as you sign off, you will check out this webinar on Facebook, share it and like it. You'll come back and check it on YouTube. You'll take a minute to subscribe online to workers.org to get coverage. It really is a great source of news, so I encourage you. You'll get an email, not a ton of emails, but an email in your box each day of news updates. And if you're interested in building with an organization of both street militants and thinkers, and so it's thinking and fighting, then check out the joinworkers.org. So let me thank Soohin Lee, Monica Moorhead, Dr. Sharat Lin, Dave Welsh, and Calvin for their contributions here today and for the material that they brought. Night. Build a worker's world.